Good morning. It's Tuesday, the 27th of May, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sunsounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader and Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman. Today, we have these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Trump considers sanctions on Russia for war. Tariff truce spurs 90-day rush to move products out of China. And bad year for Cook keeps getting worse. So turning to that first headline, Trump considers sanctions on Russia for war. President expresses frustration over new attacks in Ukraine, slows pace of talks. This is by Ann Linsky, Alexander Ward, and Josh Dawsley. Washington. President Trump is weighing new sanctions against Moscow amid frustration with the slow pace of talks to end the war in Ukraine and Russian President Vladimir Putin's escalating attacks there, including a major drone and missile assault early Monday, people familiar with Trump's thinking said. The restrictions likely wouldn't include new banking sanctions, one of the people said, but other options are under discussion to pressure the Russian leader into concessions at the negotiating table, including a 30-day ceasefire supported by Ukraine that Russia has long rejected. Trump addressed the potential of new sanctions on Sunday, saying that he is absolutely considering them. He's killing a lot of people, Trump said of Putin. I don't know what's wrong with him. What the hell happened to him? Trump is also tiring of the negotiations to end the war and is considering abandoning them altogether if a final push doesn't work, people familiar with his thinking said. A remarkable change after he campaigned on his ability to end the conflict in his first day in office. It is unclear what would happen if the U.S. retreats from the peace process and whether Trump would continue to provide military support to Ukraine. President Trump has been clear he wants to see a negotiated peace deal, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said. The developments mark a new deterioration in relations between the U.S. and Russia, which have had ups and downs even in the past few months. Trump came into office believing he was in a unique position to improve ties between the two countries because of what he viewed as his strong personal relationship with Putin. But Trump has been unable to coax major concessions from the Russian leader on a negotiated peace with Ukraine, and Putin has intensified the war. Hours after Trump's comments Sunday, Russia launched its largest ever drone and missile assault on Ukraine overnight into Monday. Ukraine's Air Force said Russia launched more than 350 explosive drones and at least 9 cruise missiles. The Russians characterized the strikes as retaliation for Ukrainian bombings within Russian territory. On Monday, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said the U.S., Germany, France, and the U.K. would no longer impose range restrictions on Ukraine's use of weapons supplied by Western allies, meaning it could target military positions deeper into Russia. To date, Ukraine has been able to use long-range missiles supplied by those countries against Russian troops only within a certain range. The Biden administration had opposed removing range limits, fearing it would escalate the war. The White House declined to comment on the restrictions. Over his first few months in office, Trump's posture toward Putin has changed frequently. He has considered new sanctions and had harsh words for the Russian leader, but has also talked about reducing trade barriers with Russia and opening the country to U.S. investments and deals. I've known him a long time, always gotten along with him, but he's sending rockets into cities and killing people, and I don't like it at all, Trump said on Sunday. We're in the middle of talking and he's sending rockets into Kyiv and other cities. I don't like it at all. It appears from these comments that President Trump is figuring out President Putin, said William Taylor, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. The question is it serious? Will this be enough to take some steps to put some sanctions on? The answer to the question seems to be that Trump is on the verge of concluding or has concluded that Putin is the obstacle. For weeks, Trump had been resisting pressure to reprimand Putin for failing to agree to a ceasefire that Ukraine supported. Allies like Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, told Trump that Putin didn't want a deal and that only punishments would make him seriously negotiate. But three key views colored Trump's thinking, officials said. First was his dislike for Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who Trump felt encouraged further conflict by pushing for sanctions, even though Zelensky agreed to a ceasefire. On Sunday, as he blasted Putin, Trump also criticized Zelensky in a post on social media where he said the Ukrainian leader is doing his country no favors by talking the way he does. Trump has also believed that additional sanctions on Russia wouldn't curb its ability to wage war, but would hamper efforts to revive U.S.-Russian economic ties. Finally, Trump felt that he knew Putin and that the Russian leader would end the war as a personal favor. Putin's unwillingness to budge has soured Trump's view of his counterpart, especially after a phone call last week during which Putin refused to sign on to a ceasefire. In a call with Zelensky and European leaders afterward, Trump said that he didn't think Putin really wanted peace, the Wall Street Journal previously reported. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate is also ramping up pressure on Russia. Graham, along with Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, introduced a measure to impose new sanctions on Russia and steep tariffs on countries that buy Russian oil, gas, and uranium, a move that has attracted backing from more than 80 of their colleagues. Trump is now on a path familiar to previous U.S. presidents who have believed they could work with Putin, only to see their efforts fail. On the campaign trail, Trump said Russia wouldn't have invaded Ukraine if he'd been in office, and has repeatedly said that he could quickly stop the fighting. And that's Trump considers sanctions on Russia for war. Our next article by Hannah Miao and Jason Douglas. Tariff truce spurs 90-day rush to move products out of China. Adam Leib is rushing to ship $700,000 of electronic typewriters from China while the trade truce holds. After forking over $23,000 for tariffs in March when President Trump hit Chinese goods with a new 20% levy, Leib, a Detroit business owner, decided to pause shipments altogether when the administration then pushed tariffs to an eye-watering 145%. Now that a 90-day truce agreed between Washington and Beijing this month has brought that down to 30%, Leib's company, Astrahaus, which makes typewriters, keyboards, and other tools for writers, is taking the opportunity to restock. I'm assuming this is probably the best-case scenario for a while, Leib said. Sky-high tariffs pummeled U.S.-China trade, and now the ceasefire is causing a snapback. Firms across the U.S. are racing to rebook canceled orders and find space on container ships to get products out of China and bring them stateside before the 90-day window closes in August. The turbulence comes as Trump over the weekend eased off his threatened 50% tariffs on the European Union, delaying until July 9th, levies he said on Friday would take effect June the 1st. In the week beginning May the 12th, when the trade truce with Beijing was announced, bookings for containers to the U.S. from China more than doubled compared with the week before as the tariff rollback unleashed a wave of pent-up demand. Bookings surged to the equivalent of around 2.2 million 20-foot boxes, a level not seen in more than a year, according to data from Vizion, a container tracking software company and data provider Dun and Bradstreet. Executives, logistics specialists, and analysts are cautious about how big the rebound will get. They say there's still too much uncertainty over tariff policy and the health of the U.S.'s consumer-driven economy to fuel a splurge in new orders. Gene Soroka, executive director of the Port of Los Angeles, said earlier this month that he doesn't anticipate a big surge in imports after the rollback. Vizion's data show container bookings last week fell back to the equivalent of around 1.4 million 20-foot containers. Nonetheless, many Chinese manufacturers are welcoming any bump in activity after the high tariffs froze orders and halted production. Lisa Wang, a salesperson at a textile manufacturer in Zhejiang province, said the tariff pause has been a huge help to her company. The company has been able to ship out about a dozen containers of previously delayed orders, mostly mattress protectors and pillows. Clients are also placing some new orders. Because we don't know what the policy will be like after 90 days, we're rushing to ship what we can now, she said. Shipping executives in Asia say one headache for importers is that there aren't enough ships available to move goods to the U.S. right away. Carriers diverted some of the vessels that would usually ship goods to the U.S. West Coast from China to other busy routes when tariffs slammed U.S.-China trade. Some carriers replaced their biggest container ships with smaller vessels, while others canceled some sailings altogether, executives say. Now, freight rates are picking up as importers compete for scarce space as carriers rush to bring ships back. The Shanghai Shipping Exchange's index of container prices to ship goods from Shanghai jumped 10% in the week beginning May the 12th compared with the week before. The next 90 days will be quite chaotic, said a senior logistics executive in Asia, who said it would take weeks to return rerouted vessels. But for many industries, 90 days isn't long enough to get products ordered, manufactured, and shipped across the Pacific. Vincent Ambrose, Chief Commercial Officer of Franklin WH Energy Storage, which makes home energy storage systems in California and Shenzhen, China, said the reprieve on tariffs isn't long enough to rush in extra stock, as manufacturing and delivery typically take about 12 weeks. Even if he could, he said he can't compete with the likes of Amazon, Apple, and Walmart for scarce space on U.S.-bound ships. There's really no opportunity to rush a bunch of products here, he said. Industry executives also say that a 30% tariff is still high enough to pinch trade, albeit not as severely as a 145% levy. Some products from China are subject to tariffs higher than the baseline 30% because of prior duties, making other countries more attractive for manufacturing still. Yes, there is a reprieve. Does that suddenly result in masses of volume? I honestly doubt it, said Niels Rasmussen, chief shipping analyst at BIMCO, an international shipping association. Godfrey Chan, who started his business as a paper goods manufacturer in China more than 30 years ago before opening a factory in northern Vietnam in 2023, said the trade truce hasn't sparked a rush back to China. Tariffs on the products he makes, which include paper bags with colorful designs for Christmas and birthdays, would total 55% if they were produced in China, compared with 10% currently on Vietnamese goods. His Vietnamese factory has been slammed with orders from customers hoping to get products as soon as possible, while tariffs on Vietnamese goods are much lower than those on Chinese imports. You can easily see the difference, Chan said. Earlier this year, the Trump administration placed tariffs of 46% on Vietnamese imports, but suspended them for 90 days, pending trade talks. Lieb, the typewriter maker, is keeping another order with his Chinese manufacturers on hold that was previously scheduled for production in August. He's worried about buying too much inventory and running short on cash if tariffs return to higher levels after the pause ends. He tried to negotiate lower prices with his Chinese manufacturers to reduce the burden of tariffs, but didn't manage to get price cuts because the factories are operating on low profit margins. Osterhaus has already raised prices up to 10% on certain products to deal with the tariff increase and is giving priority to pre-sale orders. Lieb recently toured factories in Vietnam and Indonesia to explore moving some production outside of China for the first time. I have to take it seriously now, he said. And that's tariff truce spurs 90-day rush to move products out of China. Our next headline, bad year for Cook, keeps getting worse. This is by Ralph Winkler. For Tim Cook, the hits keep coming. On Friday, President Trump targeted Apple with new demands that the company make iPhones in the U.S., threatening 25% tariffs if the company doesn't comply. Rise and shine, Tim Cook, Trump whisperer Laura Loomer posted on X, reminding the Apple chief executive he's at the center of the president's trade bullseye. That's just one of the threats Cook has confronted in what has appeared to be a no-good, very bad year for Apple. Aside from Trump, Cook is facing off against two U.S. judges, European and worldwide regulators, state and federal lawmakers, and even a creator of the iPhone, to say nothing of the cast of rivals outrunning Apple in artificial intelligence. Each is a threat to Apple's hefty profit margins, long the company's trademark and the reason investors drove its valuation above $3 trillion before any other company. Shareholders are still Cook's most important constituency. The stock's 25% fall from its peak shows their concern about whether he or anyone can navigate the choppy 2025 waters. What can be said for Apple is that the company is patient, and that has often paid off in the past. Last week, an architect of the iPhone, Joni Ivey, joined OpenAI to develop a next-generation device that weans customers off screens after he announced a deal to sell his startup to OpenAI for $6.5 billion. The Wall Street Journal reported that a goal is to deliver an AI-powered device that shifts the current computing paradigm in which humans stare at black rectangles all day. Later, OpenAI told employees it's aiming to make 100 million AI companion devices. It's hard to gauge the potential for a brand new computing device from a company that's never made one. Yet, the fact that it comes from the man who led design of the iPhone and other hit Apple products means it can't be dismissed. Apple sees the threat coming. You may not need an iPhone 10 years from now, as crazy as that sounds, and Apple executive Eddie Q testified in a court case this month. Apple isn't expected to show any AI breakthroughs at its annual developer conference in a couple of weeks. Cook said on Apple's recent earnings call that a more personalized Siri assistant hasn't arrived yet because what the company has in the shop doesn't yet meet Apple's high-quality bar. The company might not need to be first in AI. It didn't make the first music player, the smartphone, or tablet. It waited and then conquered each market with the best. A question is whether a strategy that has been successful in devices will work for AI. Apple makes billions in revenue from its services business, carrying gross profit margins north of 70% compared with less than 40% for hardware. A judge wrote in a recent ruling that Apple ignored her injunction to allow app developers to bypass its steep fees on App Store purchases. Cook chose poorly in listening to advice to ignore her, she wrote. European Union regulators want Apple to make similar changes abroad, and worldwide regulators could follow suit. State and federal lawmakers are threatening the App Store with legislation to require Apple to verify user ages. While the bottom line impact of such a move is unclear, it could reduce teen spending or even empower parents to limit teen engagement on smartphones more fully. Meanwhile, the judge overseeing an antitrust case against Alphabet's Google could demand that the search giant stop paying Apple some $20 billion annually to be the default search engine in Safari, revenue that is basically pure profit for Apple. All of these issues pale next to threats to Cook's greatest creation, Apple's supply chain in China. Trump's demands notwithstanding, there isn't much Apple can do to move iPhone production, which remains centered in China. While it's shifting final assembly of more iPhones to India, many of the components inside the device still come from across the Himalayas. The strategy gives Apple some flexibility to arbitrage different tariffs for U.S.-bound devices assembled in the two countries. Trump wants a Made in America iPhone. Such a device could cost over $3,000, so he's unlikely to get one. Cook might try to placate him by shifting production of something else to the U.S., and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent may have given Cook an out on iPhones when he said Friday, the administration wants Apple to make more of its chips here. Apple already announced plans to facilitate production of AI servers in Texas, but Trump clearly expects more. With frequent calls to the White House and a meeting there in the past week, Cook, it seems, is negotiating his next peace offering. That's bad year for Cook. Keeps getting worse. Our next article, judges weigh security changes. Trump's stepped-up criticism sparks talk of managing their own protection. This is by Catherine Long, James Finelli, and C. Ryan Barber. Amid rising tensions between the Trump administration and the judiciary, some federal judges are beginning to discuss the idea of managing their own armed security force. The notion came up in a series of closed-door meetings in early March when a group of roughly 50 judges met in Washington for a semi-annual meeting of the Judicial Conference, a policymaking body for the federal judiciary. There, members of a security committee spoke about threats emerging as President Trump stepped up criticism of those who rule against his policies. Dozens of judges and their relatives have received anonymous pizza deliveries to their homes, which they perceived as a "we know where you live" message. In March, 5 days after the Supreme Court upheld the lower court's ruling that the administration must pay USAID contractors, Justice Amy Coney Barrett's sister was targeted with a bomb threat, according to police records. Another judge had a SWAT team called on him after he overturned an executive order restricting birthright citizenship. The Supreme Court has its own dedicated police force, but other federal judges are protected by the U.S. Marshals Service, which reports to Attorney General Pam Bondi. Security committee members worried that Trump would order the marshals to stand down in retaliation for a decision that didn't go his way. They weighed one potential provocative solution: what if they commanded their own security force? Their concerns even reached Chief Justice John Roberts, who fielded anxieties from judges over a breakfast in a meeting room in the Supreme Court that their current protection may be insufficient. On Thursday, Democrat Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey introduced legislation that would allow the Chief Justice and Judicial Conference to appoint the head of the marshals, placing the courts in charge of their own security. In a statement, Booker said, "The legislation was necessary because Trump has made it abundantly clear through his words and actions that he does not respect the law, court orders, the safety of our judges, or our institutions." The marshals' dual accountability to the executive branch and the judicial branch paves the way toward a constitutional crisis, Booker said. Judge John Kogenhauer of the Western District of Washington, who had the SWAT team called on him, called the proposal to move the marshals under judiciary a wonderful idea. "There's never been any reason in the 43 years that I've been on the bench to worry that the marshals' service would do whatever was appropriate until recent years," Kogenhauer said. The Trump administration hasn't indicated to judges that it plans to remove or weaken marshals' protection, current and former federal judges said. In a statement provided by the White House, a Justice Department official said that marshals will continue to protect the safety and security of federal judges. "Any suggestion to the contrary is not only absurd, but wrong," the official said. Moving the marshals under the judicial branch would be complicated and likely politically difficult. Still, that some judges worry about the president pulling their security suggests that their relationship with the executive branch is more strained now than it's been in recent memory, said retired Judge Jeremy Fogel, now the executive director of the Berkeley Judicial Institute. "Thankfully, no one's been actually attacked recently, but there is an atmosphere of concern," Fogel said. "The mental strain of dealing with that is not insignificant." Federal judges are on the front lines of challenges to Trump's policy agenda. As rulings have reversed, at least for a time, some of the president's most attention-grabbing policies, including deporting U.S. residents without due process and stripping funding and staff from federal agencies, his supporters have rallied against judges as primary obstructions. Judges say that more money is urgently needed to meet growing security needs. Staffing for judicial security has remained largely flat in recent years, even as Marshals Service reports threats against the 800 federal judicial buildings and nearly 2,700 federal judges they protect have doubled. The agency said in its most recent annual report that it investigates thousands of communications annually to the judiciary. In addition to judicial protection, marshals have wide-ranging responsibilities, including transporting prisoners, apprehending fugitives, and operating the Witness Protection Program. The Marshals Service also plays a role in enforcing judicial orders. "I'm concerned about the constitutional crisis that occurs if the courts issue a lawful order ordering the marshals to do X," said Carl Koch, a former assistant director of the Marshall's Judicial Security Division. And then the Justice Department comes in and says, you will not execute that order. In a statement, a spokesperson for the Marshall's Service said that the security of our federal judiciary is a cornerstone of our nation's democracy, and the Marshals take that responsibility very seriously. Federal judges make hard decisions based on the rule of law in large part because the Marshals ensure they can make these decisions without fear, intimidation, or retaliation. In interviews, deputy marshals said that judicial protection is central to their agency's mission. They emphasize the importance of building trust and mutual respect with judges. You need to have a good working relationship with the judges and the court family, said Jerry Sanseverino, a former supervisory deputy marshal. But there are occasional cracks. Judges sometimes request more protection than the situation merits, former deputy marshal said, a perception underscored by some judges' demeanor toward deputies. One former supervisory deputy marshal recalled that a judge asked court security officers to wear white butler-style gloves to open and close courtroom doors, a request that rankled and which they refused. Two other former deputies said the judges sometimes seemed to view them as chauffeurs. One of those deputy marshals made a point of reminding his incoming supervisors, the chief judge is not your boss. The administrative office of the U.S. courts declined to comment. In a statement, the White House condemned attacks against the judiciary. Attacks against public officials, including judges, have no place in our society, spokesperson Harrison Fields said. Trump knows all too well the impact of callous attacks, having faced two assassination attempts. The arrest on April 25th of a Wisconsin state judge by federal agents only heightened tension between Trump and the judges. The Milwaukee judge, Hannah Dugan, was charged with obstructing the arrest of an unauthorized immigrant when she instructed him to use the side door to exit her courtroom. She pleaded not guilty. An attorney for Dugan declined to comment. What's happened to our judiciary is beyond me, Bondi said on Fox News. They are deranged is all I can think of. I think some of these judges think they are beyond and above the law, and they're not. Waves of harassment. Judges who ruled against the administration's actions in its early days quickly found themselves in the firing line. On X, Elon Musk called for an immediate wave of judicial impeachments after federal judges in Rhode Island, Washington, D.C., and New York ruled some of DOJ's actions unconstitutional in early February. Vice President J.D. Vance suggested on X that judicial rulings limiting the legitimate power of the executive were illegal. Trump, whose sister was a longtime federal judge, initially proceeded more carefully, saying he would abide by judges' rulings. But in mid-March, after U.S. District Judge James Boasberg ruled that the administration couldn't summarily deport Venezuelan migrants, the president's tone changed. This judge, like many of the crooked judges I'm forced to appear before, should be impeached, Trump wrote on Truth Social on March the 18th. The same day, Chief Justice Roberts issued a rare rebuke to the president. Impeachment, he said in a statement issued by the Supreme Court, is not an appropriate response to disagreement concerning a judicial decision. The rhetoric of the president and his allies, though, had already had an effect. As the president's words grew more heated, so did the tenor of the threats. Starting in April, some judges and their relatives received unsolicited pizza deliveries in the name of Daniel Anderl, the deceased son of U.S. District Judge Esther Salas. Anderl was shot dead in 2020 in his parents' home by a disgruntled litigant. The more you foment public anger at the judiciary, and in particular individual judges, the higher the propensity is that somebody, typically somebody who's unbalanced, will believe they're doing the work of a benefactor if they try to do harm against a judge, said retired Judge John E. Jones, who's now the president of Dickinson College. The waves of harassment can be draining, said more than a dozen judges who have experienced it. One judge said the harassment caused them to weigh the integrity of their rulings against the safety of their family. They want to let you know that they know where you live, and they want to let you know they're capable of violence and harm, said the judge who received several anonymous pizzas. It did for a brief moment make you wonder whether it was worth it, and whether you shouldn't prioritize the protection of your family and yourself in your court, the judge said. Fortunately, you get your senses back, and you do the right thing. A marshal spokesman said the agency is looking into all the unsolicited pizza deliveries and taking appropriate steps to address the matter. Scarce resources. Current and former deputies and judges say the Marshal Service is struggling to manage the increasing number of threats. We're well below the staffing allocations that the marshals say we should have on board, said Tom Bruton, the clerk of court for the Northern District of Illinois. The lack of security personnel is most acute in the courts for the D.C. District, where federal judges have handled many of the most controversial cases in recent months, including cases related to deportation and a proposed ban on transgender people in the military. Historically, the district has received more threats than any other court in the country, said former deputy marshals. Roughly 50 deputy marshals are tasked with protecting about 162 judges in the district. Deputy marshals and judges have at times asked the Marshal Service for additional staffing for judicial protection, but have been turned down because of the scarcity of resources for the entire agency, former deputy marshals said. Courthouse security is also underfunded, judges say. Two members of the Judicial Conference earlier this month asked Congress for a 19% increase in funding over last year for measures including additional barriers and screening equipment. Previous funding shortfalls meant the judiciary had to curtail some courthouse security measures, including video surveillance programs and systems that restrict access to judges' chambers, they said. They also wanted additional funding for a program that helps judges scrape their personal information from the internet, an increasingly salient concern amid heightened online harassment. Judges' home addresses appeared in hundreds of social media posts from the past 4 months reviewed by the Journal. Judges understand that some of their decisions will attract criticism and debate, retired Judge Robert Conrad, the head of the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts, wrote in testimony to the House Appropriations Committee this month. But the rhetoric has escalated to a degree that is threatening the safety of federal judges and their families, as well as the safety of court personnel, litigants, and the public in federal courthouses, he added. And that's Judges Weigh Security Changes. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona, with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman, reminding you that you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app for your iPhone or iPad from the Apple App Store or your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store. And finally, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Echo or Dot. We'll turn now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal for these headlines. Investors pile into ETFs at record pace, fears on outlook mar solid earnings season, and levies add fuel to hot sales of used cars. Our first article, investors pile into ETFs at record pace. Some $437 billion has flowed into U.S. exchange-traded funds so far in 2025. This article is by Jack Pitcher. This year's volatile, trade war-obsessed market didn't shake American investors' fondness for exchange-traded funds. In fact, it only made them love them more. Investors have plowed a record $437 billion into U.S. ETFs so far this year, unfazed by the wildest markets since COVID. And if inflows maintain the current pace, historically they accelerate in the summer and fall months, it will mark the second straight record year for U.S. ETF flows. That's happening in part because of the relentless flow of money out of mutual funds and into ETFs, which tend to offer lower fees and certain tax advantages that their older cousins can't match. But the decade-long trend doesn't fully explain this year's surge. Indeed, when U.S. markets turned choppy, many began to double down on their bets on U.S. assets, and now, more than ever, they place those wagers by buying ETFs. Investors are seeing sell-offs as buying opportunities, said Todd Rosenbluth, head of research at data provider VettaFi. The hundreds of billions of dollars that investors poured into ETFs found their way into every major fund category, stock funds and bond funds. Funds that track popular indexes continue to sell well, but so have those managed by professional stock and bond pickers, a relatively new corner of the ETF market that's gained momentum. No one fund benefited more from the surge than the ETF industry's new champ, Vanguard Group's S&P 500 ETF. The ultra-cheap index fund has soaked up a stunning $65 billion in net inflows this year, along the way becoming the world's biggest ETF by assets. Known by the ticker symbol VOO, the fund more than doubled the previous ETF annual inflow record when it took in $116 billion last year. Now it's on pace to reset that mark again by October. VOO's rise illustrates how investors more broadly turned to ETFs this year. When stock market volatility soared to a five-year high in April, Vanguard's S&P 500 fund reported its highest monthly inflows ever. Many investors had built up large cash holdings by then and had been waiting for the right moment to shift money back into stocks, according to Greg Davis, president and chief investment officer at Vanguard. During that period of tumult in early April, we saw a 5-to-1 buy-to-sell ratio, Davis said. Investors have a tremendous amount of cash sitting on the sidelines, and they know that if things are on sale, it's time to put money to work. Swelling ETF assets have been a windfall for Vanguard and the two largest U.S. fund managers. BlackRock's chief executive Larry Fink has talked repeatedly about the opportunity for his firm to capitalize on a reallocation from cash to stock and bond funds. In the United States, there's an $11 trillion sitting in money market funds, Fink said at the Saudi U.S. Investment Forum in Riyadh earlier this month. When there is an uncertainty, you're going to keep more money in cash, and that's what we witnessed. Several years after the Federal Reserve began lifting interest rates to combat inflation, the allure of cash is still strong for many investors. The second most popular ETF this year has been a BlackRock 0-to-3-month Treasury bond fund, which has almost $17 billion in inflows. The cash-like fund has a 12-month trailing yield of 4.7%. A similar offering from State Street also is in the top 10 of the flows leaderboard. We're seeing some of the defensiveness on the fixed income side, said VettaFi's Rosenbluth. With several short-term Treasury products in the top 10, that's a sign investors are happy being paid to wait. Still, equity funds have taken in a majority of this year's flows. Joining VOO in the top 10 are State Street's S&P 500 fund, Vanguard's total stock market and equity growth funds, and two NASDAQ 100 funds from Invesco. An actively managed equity fund from J.P. Morgan that aims to reduce volatility and produces above-average dividend income through an options strategy also cracked the top 10. Part of a broader class of active funds that some analysts have dubbed boomer candy, thanks to their popularity with retirees, the J.P. Morgan fund is building on a breakout 2024. Actively managed funds continue to capture an outsized share of new assets. According to Track Insight, 30% of this year's ETF flows have gone to active funds, even though they make up less than 10% of the industry's total assets. Longtime mutual fund giant Fidelity has been focusing on active ETF launches in recent years, and interest continues to grow, said Greg Friedman, Fidelity's head of ETF management and strategy. For the last 12 to 24 months, we've been seeing a very nice level of inflows, with most of it on the active side, Friedman said. That has held up even during extreme volatility. For years, investors have been swapping their mutual funds for the tax benefits and liquidity offered by ETFs, boosting inflows. That trend could soon accelerate even further. Dozens of fund managers have filed applications with the Securities and Exchange Commission to offer new ETF share classes of existing mutual funds, which would allow them to offer popular strategies in the ETF wrapper without starting from scratch. And that's investors pile into ETFs at record pace. Next, we have an article by Karen Langley, Fears on Outlook Mar Solid Earnings Season. Prominent U.S. companies have acknowledged the unpredictability of the trade war economy by yanking or dialing back their financial forecasts. Still, results from the past quarter show American corporations were on strong footing heading into April's tariff escalations. With the reporting season nearly done, profits from companies in the S&P 500 are expected to have risen about 13% in the first quarter from a year earlier, according to FactSet. At the end of March, analysts expected roughly 7% earnings growth. A solid earnings season has helped stocks claw back their losses from a tumultuous spring, leaving the S&P 500 down just 1.3% in 2025. The broad index has even gained 2.3% since President Trump's April 2nd announcement of plans for tariffs jolted markets. Reasons for cautions abound. Those include the shifts in U.S. trade policy, jitters in the bond market, and fears of a resurgence in inflation. And all come while stocks look expensive relative to history. The risks were on full display last week with a weak auction of government debt driving declines in stocks Wednesday and fresh tariff broadsides from Trump fueling losses Friday. "It's pretty muddy right now," said Ryan Kelly, Chief Investment Officer at Hennessy Funds. "We need time to go by to really see the effects of tariffs and the effects of the uncertainty." Investors entered the earnings season that kicked off in April, hoping corporate executives would shed light on how Trump's tariff plans would affect business and profits. They parsed first quarter results for clues about how the uncertainty surrounding trade and pessimism among consumers might have affected business. This week, investors will seek fresh insights into the effects on companies they study results from, AutoZone, NVIDIA, and Costco Wholesale. They'll also scrutinize data on consumer confidence and jobless claims. For some investors, the better-than-expected earnings season provided welcome assurance that the U.S. economy and their bets on U.S. companies were holding up. People were thinking that the economy was slowing down, that employment would slow down, and that would negatively impact earnings. But that did not happen, said Mary Ann Bartels, Chief Investment Strategist at Sanctuary Wealth. And in fact, earnings came in significantly stronger than what investors were anticipating. Investors hoping to hear about tariffs on companies' earnings calls weren't disappointed. Through Thursday, tariffs were mentioned on the earnings calls of 2,136 U.S. publicly traded companies, the most in quarterly data going back to 2016, according to AlphaSense. But those discussions didn't necessarily yield the clarity many sought. Some companies offered frank admissions that they don't know what the future holds. Delta Airlines, Ford Motor, and clog and sandal company Crocs were among those setting aside their financial outlooks for the year altogether. Walmart drew attention when the retail giant said it would raise prices this month and early this summer as tariff-affected merchandise reaches store shelves. Trump then criticized Walmart on social media, illustrating the risks for companies as they navigate the trade war. Several of Walmart's fellow retailers struggled this past week, with Target stock dropping after the company reported disappointing results, and shares of TJ Maxx owner TJX falling after the off-price retailer gave quarterly guidance that analysts found conservative. The first quarter wrapped up before Trump revealed the extent of his tariff plans. For some investors, that means companies' results are of limited use in forecasting how they'll perform going forward. The quarter itself was a throwaway, said Jim Polk, head of equity investments at Homestead Advisors. It was really more around these unknowns that we're trying to figure out what's going to happen over the next, not only this year, but in the next couple years. Friday brought a reminder of just how unpredictable the path ahead is for companies and shareholders. Trump threatened to impose a 50% tariff on European Union within days and warned Apple that iPhones manufactured abroad could face import taxes. The S&P 500 dropped 0.7% for the day, while Apple shares retreated 3%. Earlier in the week, stocks faltered when a disappointing auction for 20-year Treasury bonds stoked worries about rising deficits. Some investors have grown uneasy about the issuance of government debt that could follow Trump's multi-trillion dollar in fiscal package. Consumers are worried that inflation could heat up again. Respondents to a recent University of Michigan survey said they expect prices to surge 7.3% over the next year, the highest reading since 1981. Still, the earnings season has offered some reassurance. At the end of the day, you can't knock the fact that we've had some really good earnings growth, and that's very good for the overall S&P, Kelly said. Now, though, we have to see what happens from here. And that's fears on outlook mar solid earnings season. We'll turn now to levies add fuel to hot sales of used cars. This is by Ryan Felton, Carleton, Michigan. Used cars haven't been in such short supply at such high prices since the days of COVID. Dealers had a 43-day supply of used cars at the start of May, the lowest level for this time of year since 2021, according to Cox Automotive, an automotive service business. The average price of the 50 best-selling used cars in the U.S. has increased each week over the past 2 months to nearly $29,000, according to Cox Automotive data. That compares with an average of more than $48,000 for a new car. The pricing and inventory changes are fueled by several factors. Americans are holding on to their vehicles longer, and new car prices are rising. President Trump's tariffs are adding to the upward pressure on prices. While tariffs don't hit used cars directly, they're causing carmakers to raise prices and are reducing supply. Ford Motor and Subaru have announced price increases. Many automakers have cut back on imported vehicles from Mexico and Canada. North American car factories produced 8% fewer cars and trucks in April compared with a year earlier, mostly as a result of lower output from Mexico, according to a research note from Citi. Our expectation is that over the course of the summer, used prices are going to rise even more quickly, said Charlie Cheesebro, senior economist at Cox Automotive. At a used car auction south of Detroit last week, 17 garage doors slid open at 9 a.m., and used vehicles started rolling out. Jeep Grand Cherokees, Range Rovers, Ford trucks, a Lamborghini Huracan. At each lane, auctioneers began announcing the current high bids in a lightning-fast, barely intelligible staccato, banging gavels to signify a new offer. Potential buyers quickly looked over late-model Ford Broncos and Chevrolet Silverados, raising their hands to signify a bid. A television screen behind each auctioneer booth displayed the current price of the vehicle as well as its mileage and year of production. Every few seconds, a flashing green light signified an incoming bid from the internet. I think a lot of the stores are short on inventory, said Scott Graham, a buyer for a Michigan-based dealer group who was on the auction floor. He said competition has become more intense in recent weeks. Everybody's down on cars right now, he added, referring to depleted dealer inventories. Graham won 3 vehicles at the auction. With supplies down and prices up, many car buyers are turning to the used vehicle market for lower prices. Auto retailers are now looking to fill diminished car lots with used vehicles and finding their competitors are all trying to do the same thing. Stephen Wolf, a Ford and Jeep dealer in Houston, said he had to travel to Utah to buy pickup trucks after running low on some models. You can't sell out of an empty basket, Wolf said. You've got to have inventory here. The shallow pool of available used cars means prices likely will remain high for months, industry analysts and dealers say. Rental car companies, historically a crucial source of used vehicles, reduced their fleet size in recent years. Leased vehicles, another common source of lightly used cars, are also in short supply because so few leasing transactions happen during the pandemic. Dealers typically replenish their used car lots when customers return leased cars or sell their old vehicles. They can also go to the auction route. Manheim Detroit, which ran the auction south of the city, holds sales three times a week. On an average day, 600 vehicles are put up for auction. About 15,000 more vehicles, including electric vehicles, large pickup trucks, and cheap damaged cars sold for scrap metal, are stored on a 250-acre lot at any given time before typically being bought in about 10 days. On Thursday, the auction house hummed along with dealers and their representatives jostling for supply. Supplies have been constrained, and I think it's particularly constrained for nice cars, said Glenn Gottfried, sales manager at an Ann Arbor dealership that sells Volvo, Lincoln, and Mazda models. There's lots of stuff that's lived a challenged life, hasn't been maintained well, has accident experience. Those cars are available, he said. But genuinely nice cars are hard to find. And that's levies add fuel to hot sales of used cars. Then we have an article by Micah Maidenberg and Becky Peterson. SpaceX goes all in on its Starship. SpaceX is shifting personnel and resources to its powerful new rocket, hoping to have the vehicle ready for a Mars mission next year. Elon Musk's space company is making an enormous bet on Starship, which stands roughly 400 feet tall at liftoff and remains in an experimental phase. SpaceX is aiming to address the technical challenges ahead with Starship while continuing to fly the operational spacecraft and rockets that made the company a powerhouse. In recent months, employees have been moving into Starship roles, including some Dragon spacecraft staffers, who were reassigned in mid-May, according to people familiar with the matter. SpaceX also has been making big investments in its complex in Texas for the vehicle and has similar plans for Florida. The company faces near-term pressure to show that Starship can function, as Musk and other executives have promised. It's behind schedule on work preparing a variant of Starship for a National Aeronautics and Space Administration mission to the moon, currently set for 2027, people familiar with those efforts have said. This year, SpaceX struggled with back-to-back Starship flight tests that ended in explosions. The incidents disrupted airline traffic in Florida and the Caribbean region as debris fell. SpaceX is planning another test flight of the vehicle Tuesday evening. In a statement Friday, the company said it had conducted extensive testing to understand the failure of its latest mission and made changes for the next one. Reaching its goals with Starship won't always come in leaps, SpaceX said. It's definitely been a rough start of the year for Starship, Shana Diaz, an engineering executive at SpaceX, said in a post on X after the second recent explosion. A single issue can cause a launch to fail, she said, and when factoring in costs and time, the overall problem can feel quite daunting. Big promises. One of the Starship-related projects that SpaceX staff recently moved over to is called Starfall. It's tied to a military effort to one day use the vehicle to whisk military gear around the globe, the person familiar said. Military officials and space companies for years have researched using rockets to rapidly move cargo. The idea is spacecraft could ferry large amounts of material to bases or remote locations an hour or so after launching and flying through space. SpaceX in 2017 posted an animation online showing people in New York boarding a Starship on a barge and flying through space to Shanghai in 39 minutes. But executives haven't spoken much lately about so-called point-to-point Starship efforts. The company said in a legal filing last year it aims to conduct a rocket cargo mission for the Air Force where Starship would attempt to transport and land more than 66,000 pounds of government cargo. It then said it expected to receive about $149 million tied to further developing Starship for the cargo efforts. Mars mission. Musk has been pushing SpaceX to try to launch a Starship spacecraft on an uncrewed mission to Mars next year. Taking a shot at the Red Planet in that time frame would require SpaceX to overcome engineering obstacles. An advantage of possibly flying there in 2026 is that Earth and Mars will be closer together, making a flight easier. One major challenge for any mission, in-orbit fueling. Rockets and spacecraft typically are loaded with all of their fuel on the ground, but SpaceX aims to fuel up Starships while they're in orbit for deep space missions. Staffers have discussed Starship making a trip to Mars with three in-space refuels, people familiar with the matter said. Transferring propellant in space at the scale SpaceX is proposing for Starship hasn't been done before, and the company hasn't tried to move fuel between two vehicles in orbit. The propellants must remain at super cold temperatures or they can boil off. SpaceX's goal of flying to Mars next year might dovetail with the Trump administration's new priorities at NASA. In a recent budget proposal, the White House called for adding $1 billion in funding for Mars-focused efforts and large cuts across many other agency programs. Musk founded SpaceX more than two decades ago to ultimately try to send people to the Red Planet and has described making humanity multiplanetary as an animating feature of his life. The CEO of SpaceX, Tesla, and other companies have said he wants to include a robot under development at Tesla on a Mars flight in 2026. Starship departs for Mars at the end of next year carrying Optimus, Musk said in a post on X in March. And that's SpaceX goes all in on its Starship. Well, that concludes this Tuesday edition of the Wall Street Journal here on SunSounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Thank you for joining me for this day's edition of the Wall Street Journal. And remember, you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other SunSounds of Arizona programming streaming on the SunSounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or on the SunSounds of Arizona app, available from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad, or from the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And you can also listen to SunSounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo.